Lots of culinary schools around the country have restaurants that serve meals to the public. But Shannon Mullen reports on one program in New England where the students aren't just chefs in training, they're also inmates.
The Fife and Drum restaurant is on the outskirts of historic Concord, Massachusetts. It has a school cafeteria feel with linoleum floors and card tables under bright blue plastic tablecloths. And it serves only lunch, but a hot meal made mostly from scratch costs just $3.21.
When I first started coming here, it was $1.42.
Bob Hertz has been having lunch here a few times a week for 20 years.
It's been a fantastic price, and the food's good. Some people are a little nervous about the environment. We had a group of women come from an insurance company. As they walked in, there was a frisk going on. And we saw them once and never saw them again. So it depends on the person.
To get a table at the Fife and Drum, first you have to go through security. The restaurant is inside the Northeast Correctional Center, a minimum security prison.
Gravy looks all set. It's 11:15, so 15 minutes till showtime.
Calvin Hodge is halfway through a six-year sentence. He and his fellow students have been in the kitchen since 7 a.m. prepping today's meal.
Mashed potatoes, the stuffing, vegetables, green beans, and cranberry sauce and gravy on top.
Today, Hodge is head chef, but the inmates rotate jobs every 5 weeks.
It gives me that experience of working in a real restaurant. So when I do go home, I can say I got X amount of time of real experience, hands-on everything, feeding to the public, and I can cook pretty good, so I should be able to get a position somewhere.
Prison officials say their vocational education programs give inmates real skills that they can use to find work when they're released, and that reduces the risk that they'll reoffend. The culinary program spends about $500 a week on food, offset by what customers pay. And the restaurant has a lot of regulars, including Mark Higgins.
It's definitely different being here for lunch, but I enjoy it very much. Of course, we don't want to say how really good it is because the secret will be out.
Well, right now I'm just serving the turkey.
Calvin, you might have to go like a little piece. You know what I mean?
The inmate's instructor, Kim Lukatich, came here from a regular culinary school, and she says there are some unique challenges to running one in a prison. For one thing, the knives are tethered to the tables or locked in cabinets. The inmates have to learn a lot of skills on the job, in addition to waiting tables.
They get to kind of get acclimated to talking to people again, associating with people again. You know, it takes a little getting used to for anybody, customer service. But yeah, these guys are really doing a nice job.
See you again. How are we doing?
Good.
Thanks for coming in today. What can I get you?
Mark Molina is a first-time nonviolent offender serving a three-year sentence. This month, he's waiting tables and baking desserts.
This baking stuff is like a chemistry. You got to get everything just right. You know, if you screw up one thing, it's kind of... It comes out like a brick rather than a cake, you know.
But Molina says the hours go by quickly, and he's grateful for that. His favorite part of the day is when he and his classmates get to sit down and try what they've made.
Oh, man. Great. Calvin, you outdid yourself, buddy. Great.
Came out good.
As for Molina's baking skills, his chocolate cream pie gets an A+. For NPR News, I'm Shannon Mullen.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. We have our regular Friday features coming up in Faith Matters. We'll talk about a provision in the new health care law that would require employers, including many religious institutions, to cover contraception in their employee health plans. We'll hear more about why some religious leaders are outraged about this and why the White House says it will not back down. That's in a few minutes. And the Barbershop Guys will be here later on their Super Bowl picks. And we'll also tell you about the NFL's new fashion offerings for the ladies. That's all coming up. But first, we want to spend some time talking about an issue that President Obama highlighted in his State of the Union address last week. The large number of students who drop out of high school. Nationally, out of every four students who start public high school, one doesn't finish on time or at all. That according to the U.S. Department of Education. Yesterday, we talked about the situation nationally and in the nation's capital, which is struggling to keep students in school. We met a young woman who had dropped out but has since gone back. But in some places like Nevada, the numbers are particularly grim. That state has the lowest graduation rate in the country, according to federal figures, just 56%. Now, a multi-million dollar federal grant has encouraged one Nevada school district to use tough love to bring dropouts back to class. School officials are calling it the Reclaim Your Future program. And as part of that effort, school officials in Clark County spent last Saturday knocking on the doors of students who had dropped out, trying to convince them to come back. We wanted to hear more about all this, so we've called on Nettie Alvarez. She is the principal of Western High School, and this week she is profiled in the Las Vegas Sun series on that city's so-called turnaround schools. Also with us is Paul Takahashi. He is an education reporter with the Las Vegas Sun who's been following the district's efforts, and they're both with us. Welcome to you both. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you for having us.
Nettie Alvarez, I'd like to start with you. Only 43% of the students who started your school in 2006 actually graduated with their class in 2010, according to the district's figures. Why do you think that is?
There's many reasons that, you know, they drop out. There are reasons, you know, poverty, pregnancy, students not being engaged. They don't see a value, no connection. There's not a value there for them. Some of them have lost of credits. In the 9th and 10th grade, they lose their credits. They haven't passed their proficiency exams. Then they don't see that there's a light at the end of the tunnel. So they think that, you know, there's no reason for them to return. So they drop out.
Paul Takahashi, one of the things I learned from your series is that it has not always been this way. For in the 2002-2003 school year, graduation rate in Nevada was 72%. But as we said most recently, it was 56%. Why? Two questions. Why does Nevada have the lowest graduation rate in the country, and why has the trend gotten worse?
Well, there are many different factors, as Nettie just said. There are, you know, factors of poverty. Las Vegas, of course, was really wrecked hard by this recession. It has the highest unemployment rate in the country. You know, recent numbers came out today for the national level, but we're at least 5 percentage points higher. You know, Las Vegas is the foreclosure and bankruptcy rate capital in the nation. And so you've got a lot of different factors here that lead to homelessness among students. You know, that give rise to things such as crime and drugs and alcohol abuse. And a lot of those things, of course, impact family life. You know, families working two or three jobs just to make ends meet. And so you've got a lot of students here who might be working to help support their families. And so the recession has really hit Las Vegas very hard. Some of those graduation rate numbers, of course, have been inflated over the years as the school districts across the nation look towards a more accurate graduation figure. And so Las Vegas has had a fairly low graduation rate over the years.
So, in fact, the latest figure, there probably isn't as big of a gap as we're seeing. You're saying that part of it is the previous number was probably inflated before, and this is really a more accurate picture, and including
right,
all the numbers that you mentioned. So, Nettie Alvarez, as we mentioned, that you recently, along with a number of other school officials and a lot of volunteers, went door-to-door last Saturday trying to track down students who had dropped out. What were you hoping to accomplish, and do you think you succeeded?
Well, we're trying to reclaim our students, the students that have dropped out, and that's the whole purpose of this initiative. And yes, I believe, you know, once if it's just one student, it's one more. It's one more that we have at school that we can put them on a program so that they're able to graduate. So I think it's a great initiative that our superintendent, Dwight Jones, and deputy superintendent, Pedro Martinez, have implemented. And this past Saturday was the second time around that we've done this. And, you know, the first time was in September, and we were able to claim some. And this time around, we went out not just for the seniors. We were looking at students who had attendance issues. So we were out knocking on doors and trying to get, you know, speak to the parents. Why isn't your child coming to school? They need to come to school. We want them to graduate. And giving them different alternatives and having a plan of action for them so that they can see, you know, there are different routes that we have here at school. There are different things that are being implemented so that you can be successful. There's credit retrieval classes. There's different programs that Clark County has instituted for our students. And I think it's a very positive thing. This is not something that our school district has ever done. This is the first time that we've done this. It was a very positive thing for me, and to go out and visit with the parents and speak to the parents. And I know, as same with my colleagues who were also out there, and the superintendent who was out there visiting homes, it's great to see, you know, some their smile on their faces, like, you care. You really want us to come back, and it's, yes, we want you to come back. You know, we need you at school. It's for your future. There's a reason why you need to graduate. And I truly believe that some of our students just, and I'm only speaking for Western, you know, my students at Western, and speaking with them, I have students who have stated to me, I don't know why I need a high school diploma. You know, what's the reason? You know, my parents didn't go to school. They haven't attended, and they're being, you know, they have a job and they're doing okay. That's true for some, not for all. And it's changing a whole mindset in a school like ours that's at risk.
Sure.
And we have a high, Hispanic population.
Let me jump in here. I'm speaking with Nettie Alvarez. She's the principal of Western High School in Las Vegas. We're talking about efforts to get high school dropouts to come back to school. Principal Alvarez, among other school officials and volunteers, went door to door last weekend to try to persuade students who had dropped out to come back to school. Also with us, Paul Takahashi. He's a reporter for the Las Vegas Sun, who's been reporting on efforts like this. You know, on this program yesterday, as I mentioned earlier, we talked about high dropout rates in Washington, D.C., the nation's capital. WAMU reporter Kavitha Cardoza talked about some of the challenges she sees in the schools that she's covered. I just want to play a short clip from that conversation.
A lot of times these children have so much going on in their lives, they either check out, so they're distracted, they put their heads down, go to sleep, or sometimes they start arguing with the teacher. So often when they're out of class, the teachers feel, oh, we can concentrate on the students who are here who really want to learn.
What about that, Principal Alvarez? Have you found that to be true, that in fact there's some mixed signals there, that even though the system, you know, of course teachers want to teach, but that it actually can be harder than many people might think to reintegrate students who've had a lot of time out of the classroom? Do you think that's true?
It's very true. It's hard to get students engaged. And, of course, it's a whole mindset that we're changing, especially at Western. And it's having the right people in the right place and everyone, you know, having the common goal. Our goal as educators is to educate our kids. And at Western, you know, we don't allow kids to sleep in class. You're probing kids. You're engaging them in activities. You have to show that school has a value, and that, you know, our big thing is capturing kids' hearts, where kids know that our teachers are caring, that they want them to succeed. Some of our students haven't had that in the past.
Sure. Paul, let me bring you back into the conversation, Paul Takahashi. You also reported on the other initiatives by people outside of the school system in the community to try to wrap their arms around these kids. Can you tell us a little bit about that? I mean, particularly you can see where a student, perhaps if his parents are both unemployed, and he or she might feel real pressure to help out at home. So what are some of the other initiatives to try to get kids back in school?
Sure. This Reclaim Your Future initiative is a graduation initiative, of course, started by the new superintendent here. And it's a wide range of different activities, and the cornerstone of it being these community door-to-door walks, trying to get kids to, you know, who might have dropped out to come back to school. But there are a whole other, a number of different aspects, the most recent being this program, a mentorship program, to attract about 2,000 mentors to help, you know, about 2,000 students. And so you've got a lot of different community members and volunteers and organizations, nonprofits that are coming in and really trying to help these students. One of them, a partnership between fairly large nonprofit groups here, bringing in a counselor to help, students at 10 of these schools that are some of the worst performing in the county. So this is a very promising sign. With the economy the way it is here, there's a huge emphasis on, you know, diversifying the economy here, and education is really the key to that, a lot of leaders say.
Nettie, Principal Alvarez, we only have a minute left, so I need you to be brief, if you can. I remember you saying that you at one point almost dropped out. What is it that kept you in the game?
Well, what kept me in the game, of course, my teachers and my parents, who also pushed me to make sure that I went to school, because they didn't have the opportunity from their country to go to school. That wasn't an option. So that was one thing that was always instilled here. And, you know, in America, Nettie, that's why we're here. So you can go to school, you can graduate, because that will be your future. And so it was just everyone pushing and, you know, pulling me forward, that I do believe that that's why I'm here, and that's kind of what I feel that I have to give back to this community is that.
Well, good. Let's check back in and later in the year and just see, maybe toward graduation, and see how it all worked out. Nettie Alvarez is the principal of Western High School in Las Vegas. Paul Takahashi is an education reporter for the Las Vegas Sun. He's been reporting on the district's efforts to get dropouts to come back to high school. They were both kind enough to join us from member station KNPR in Las Vegas. Thank you both so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thanks so much.
To hear our conversation from yesterday on high school dropouts in the nation's capital, Washington, D.C., please visit our website. Go to npr.org. Click on the Programs tab and then tell me more.
A scandal at a Los Angeles elementary school is growing. Earlier this week, a longtime teacher at Miramonte Elementary was taken into custody. He's accused of lewd behavior with at least 23 children. And today, a second teacher was arrested after being removed from the school amid allegations of abuse. Vanessa Romo of member station KPCC has our story, but first, a warning. This report contains disturbing content.
In Spanish, Miramonte literally means lookout hill. Parents of students at the South LA Elementary School appear shaken that no one seemed to be looking out for them or their children. They're outraged, angry, deeply disturbed, and like Kimberly Kirkland, they have a lot of questions.
My number one question is that he's been working here for 30 years, so is this 23 victims within a 30-year span, or is this 23 victims within the last few years? How far back does this date?
At this point, police are saying it goes back to 2005. 61-year-old Mark Burnt is accused of a variety of disturbing acts, including a tasting game in which he gagged and blindfolded children and spoon-fed them a white substance that DNA tests revealed to be his semen. Burnt was brought to the attention of authorities when a CVS photo processor reported the disturbing images. He was arrested Monday following a year-long investigation that was conducted unbeknownst to parents at the elementary school. And that has left the community reeling, especially as new information continues to surface. The latest, a second teacher was removed from class early yesterday morning after a student alleged inappropriate behavior by the teacher. LA County Sheriff's Special Victims Unit is now conducting an investigation. And yesterday, police disclosed a previous investigation into Burnt dating back almost two decades. A 9-year-old student of Burnt accused him of fondling her in class during a test. Sergeant Dan Scott.
While she was sitting at her at a table, Mr. Burnt came up to her and reached under the table towards her genitals. She pushed his hand away. And that was all that happened.
An investigation was launched, but in the end, LA County District Attorney dropped the case because there was insufficient evidence at the time to prove that a crime had occurred. Tamira Long is furious that parents were left in the dark, and she's dismayed that 10 victims are still unidentified.
Which is like, it's crazy because if you guys have been conducting this investigation for over a year, then you should have all the information you need thus far.
Long says, like other parents, she fears for her children enough to seriously consider transferring schools.
Now, I'm just trying to make sure none of my kids were involved because I have a 5-year-old that goes here and my 13-year-old used to go here. She graduated from this school.
Santiago and Chacha Martinez have 4 kids at Miramonte Elementary, from kindergarten to 3rd grade, and they want to see the photos depicting the children playing Burnt's so-called games.
Everybody wants to see pictures to see if it's their kid or not, but they're not showing any.
Due to privacy matters, like with other people, but if it's your kid, then they'll contact you.
LAUSD Superintendent John Daisy has launched an internal investigation by the district, independent of the sheriff's case. He said he can't fathom how Burnt could have escaped detection.
I'm a dad. And you can't think of a worse breach of trust. It's the most despicable thing that could happen to students. And the message is, that's why we have a criminal justice system. That's why we have the police. I hope the man is locked away for the rest of his life and then some.
Burnt's arraignment has been postponed until next month. His bail is set at $23 million. For NPR News, I'm Vanessa Romo in Los Angeles.
Listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
to New York City now, where small churches have been meeting in public schools for years. Some want cheap rental space. Others are part of a church planting movement. The idea is to plant congregations in unconventional settings to attract potential members. Last year, a federal court ruled that these school gatherings violate separation of church and state laws. And as Fred Mogul from member station WNYC reports, the congregations now have 1 week left to vacate.
For the past 6 years, Grace Fellowship Church has been meeting on Sundays in the auditorium of PS 150 in Queens. It looks like a lot of assembly halls in old red brick schools, with wooden seats, terrazzo floors, and murals depicting scenes of art and culture. When Rob Powers first started coming to Grace Fellowship, he felt a little bit like he was back in elementary school.
It was a little odd, but I mean, it's New York City, so you get used to stuff quickly.
He says the non-traditional setting is part of the appeal.
To me, the style of worship service is a big deal, so I'm not really into the huge congregation where you just blend in. So it is nice to have a smaller family-style worship.
As of last year, there were about 160 churches meeting in city schools. It's not clear how many still are. New York City has been trying to evict the churches for well over a decade. The city prevailed last year when a federal appeals court defined what kind of religious groups can meet in schools and what kind can't.
You have a right to pray, of course. You have a right to worship. Freedom of religion is critical.
Donna Lieberman leads the New York Civil Liberties Union, which joined New York City in the lawsuit.
But freedom for a church to take over a school and convert it into a house of worship is not what our Constitution stands for.
The churches argue they're not taking over schools and they're not trying to convert anyone, a claim the NYCLU challenges. The U.S. Supreme Court has said religious clubs can meet in schools for Bible study, prayer, and other explicitly religious activities. Yet the High Court also accepted the appeals court decision that formal worship services are different than club activities and violate the separation of church and state. Back at PS 150, Grace Fellowship congregants are eating pizza in the school cafeteria after services. Pastor John Stork says the church has helped build and repair things at the school, and both sides benefit from the church's presence there. He's applied to the city for a new permit to rent space for the activities that are allowed.
The court's not banning prayer and religious instruction and singing of hymns. They're just banning that in the context of a worship service. So we would stop having church worship, but come together and eat together. We probably have basically a Sunday school class.
The City Department of Education wouldn't comment on Grace Fellowship's application. The church has a temporary place to worship after next Sunday, but members are praying there'll be a way for them to stay in school. For NPR News, I'm Fred Mogul in New York.